Hi, Sander Gilman.
Hello, Max Cohen. How are you?
Fine. You just published a new book about obesity. Could you tell us something about it?
Well, the book is called Obesity, the Biography, and it appeared with Oxford University Press a couple of months ago. And what I tried to do in this book is to outline a history of obesity from the ancient Greeks, from Tanakh through last week, with a certain focus on how we have imagined obesity in various cultures and how various cultures have responded to the notion of obesity.
So what did you see and what did you want to show?
Well, what I saw was that every culture, from ancient China to America in 2011, and even France, has an anxiety about obesity. Obesity becomes a medical category, but every single culture defines it differently, understands it having different causes, sometimes multiple causes, and sees it as a danger to the individual or to society in different ways. So while we all use the word fat, or we all use the word obesity, we oftentimes mean very different things, and we mean different things at different times.
So nowadays, what does it mean?
Well, today we have sort of two major understandings of obesity. The one is that obesity is a failure of will. We now have all of this food that's available in the first world and the developing world, and we don't do as much hard work, and therefore we become fat. Now, some of the variants of that has to have to do with the fact that it's fast food or it's laziness, but it's basically a kind of social explanation. But then there's another explanation which is equally powerful. And that powerful explanation is that we are genetically programmed as human beings, right? So it's a completely ahistoric argument to gather up fat when there are fat years and to survive then the thin years. And you remember Joseph's dream, right? About the seven fat kine and the seven skinny kine, right? Now, that argument says, well, there's a universal obesity gene, which is normal. In other words, the first argument, the social argument, argues that this is a pathology, and the second one argues that it's normal, but it's normal only because we have this history, and it's become a danger now, not because we're eating too much fast food, but because, in point of fact, we are no longer having these moments of starvation. And these two notions kind of compete with one another. The reality, of course, is that each person gets fat or doesn't get fat for a multitude of reasons, some of them metabolic, some of them of the body, some of them of society, and some of them of genetics.
You wrote a book about difference and pathology also. Is there any connection between your two books?
Absolutely, absolutely. And the idea of difference in pathology was that one of the ways that we imagine people who are not ourselves, people who are different, in other words, by the way, positively or negatively, has to do with notions of either that they are sicker than we are, or perhaps that they are healthier than we are, right? By the way, being healthy is not necessarily a good thing, right? The Jews, for example, are seen as having a immunity to tuberculosis in the 19th and early 20th century, but that was given then other kinds of explanations, which made the Jews different in a way that wasn't necessarily a good thing. But the obesity argument is absolutely the same thing. We look at people who are fat, we create an idea that we ourselves are not those people, and then we create explanations for why we are not obese, why we are not at risk for obesity, and they are obese.
So this is a question of difference also.
Difference between
thin and fat people and so on.
Yeah, and again, if you understand thinness and fatness as arbitrary categories, and it's very interesting because the idea of what a fat man or a fat woman looks like today, if you go back 100 years ago, those are mostly categories which would not have been seen either as obese or as unhealthy. What was stout in 1890 is morbidly obese today. What was healthily corpulent in 1890s is a body that is exposed to all sorts of diseases like type 2 diabetes and cardiac diseases today. So it really is a question of how we imagine what thinness and what fatness is. And by the way, I'll point out to you that 50 years ago, certainly in the United States, and to a lesser extent in Europe, the obsession was not with the fat body, but with the too thin body, with the anorexic body, the body that was so thin that it was in danger of dying. And that was the psychopathology that people were worried about, and it was seen as a psychopathology of young, middle-class women. Today, obesity is seen as a disease, for the most part, of the poor. Rich people are seen as having access to better food at the gyms, which is not true either, by the way.
You wrote also a book about Jewish self-hatred. There is a kind of self-hatred between fat and thin people. Is there any connection with that book also?
Well, the Jewish self-hatred book is a book about how you live in a society that has images about yourself and how you adapt your own sense of who you are to those images. And certainly when you interview obese people today, they share the notion of obesity as being a kind of either psychological or genetic problem. They see it, however, as something sort of embarrassing. You know, the obese are the last people, including the Jews, that you can make jokes about today. You know, I mean, on television, people make jokes about fat people all the time. You couldn't make the same jokes about Jews today. And so, absolutely, obese people begin to think of themselves as inferior because the image of the obese person is a person out of control. Whether or not their obesity, by the way, is caused by their overeating or by metabolic problems or by their genetic predisposition.
All this does concern the problem of identity.
It's central. I mean, all of this is a question of identity. And it also is a question about how our identities, as Freud argues, how our identities are shaped by our existence in the real world, by the way the real world sees us. Freud talks about this as superego formation, but it's also part of ego formation, about the way we react to the world, what defense mechanisms we put up to guard against the world and to try to create ourselves as separate and autonomous individuals. So, you know, it's not identity in the political sense. It's not the identity in the sense of the political arguments about identity, but it has to do with shaping who we imagine we are based on the worlds in which we live.
You also publish a new, it's not actually completely new, a book about Wagner and cinema. So, yeah, what is it about?
The cinema book continues my ongoing fascination with opera as a form, and a form that is not only high art, because one of the interesting problems about high art is that it's seen as elitist, but opera infiltrates mass culture and popular culture in a very interesting way. And when I sat down to do the book on Wagner and cinema, what I wanted to understand was how Wagner's very determined high culture operas, Wagner is very different than Verdi. Wagner is aiming at a real cultural elite that he wants to create, right? Including, by the way, the German Jews who become great Wagnerianers, as opposed to Verdi, who wants to create a popular sang the tunes in the streets. But Wagner gets adapted much more than Verdi into cinema, both in terms of films based on Wagner operas, but even more importantly on the use of Wagner and Wagner's music in movies from Bugs Bunny cartoons to the film Apocalypse Now. And somehow or another, we have that music in our ears in a way that most of us don't imagine it being there. Most of us, if I ask somebody, do they know any Wagner tunes, the answer is no. But if I play them, then the helicopter scene from Apocalypse Now, they immediately know the chorus of the Valkyrie. So it's absolutely a great example.
Thank you very much, Sander.
You're welcome, Max.